Hi, everybody. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, set off a firestorm last week when he said this.
On the issue of critical race theory, et cetera, I'll obviously have to get much smarter on whatever the theory is. But I do think it's important, actually, for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read. And the United States Military Academy is a university, and it is important that we train and we understand, and I want to understand white rage, and I'm white.
Now, the reaction to his comments have been, let's just say, out of proportion, and also more than a little rude.
He's not just a pig, he's stupid.
Like so many other aspects of this recent, somewhat disingenuous debate over critical race theory, the general's comments ended up revealing more about his critics than they exposed about him. On Friday, J.D. Vance, the author and social media firestarter, tweeted, quote, "What I find so enraging about the Joint Chiefs pandering on progressive wokeness is that they know damn well the geography and politics of who dies in American wars. The conservative Americans you trash are disproportionately bleeding for this country." Unquote. Now, I'm not sure if Vance knows that African Americans make up 19% of the active duty enlisted, which means black folk are disproportionately fighting and bleeding for the country. But bad statistics aside, General Milley's comments and the criticism that those comments evoked raise important questions about who can lay claim to serving and sacrificing for the nation. And here to explore that with me is Scott Ferris, author of Freedom on Trial, the first post-Civil War battle over civil rights and voter suppression. Great to talk with you again, Scott.
Hello, Melissa. It's always a pleasure.
It feels to me like January 6th revealed some serious problems with former military and police officers being radicalized. Couldn't an exploration being widely read of issues of race help to address that?
Oh, I would agree 100% with that, Melissa. I mean, obviously, we know that groups like the Proud Boys, Patriot Prayer, Oath Keepers, et cetera, have made no secret of the fact that they're encouraging their members to join the military as well as local police forces. I guess they have some sort of fantasy about someday being in a position of authority if they ever have to take over the United States government or something like that. So I think it's a problem that General Milley was certainly wise to raise. I hope it's not very extensive. In fact, we don't have good data to know how extensive neo-Confederate and white supremacist views are in the military, but it's certainly a concern. And the military, being one of the most integrated institutions in American society, you mentioned that 19% of all the active duty are African-Americans and 40% are people of color. Obviously, you want to have an organization of that size be harmonious, and so you need people to understand each other, understand their backgrounds, understand their special experiences. And so I think, as you said, General Milley's offering the fairly commonsensical notion that, hey, I should learn about all the people under my commands and understand how they think so that they can all work better together.
Now, J.D. Vance is an author of Hillbilly Elegy and thinks about working class folks. And it does seem to me that there's a working class overrepresentation in the military. Is that right?
Well, I'm sure there's some degree there's some truth to that in the sense that it's an all-volunteer army, so it is self-selected. And I think a lot of people who don't have obvious pathways to success in business and other things see the military as a great career or in a way to raise money for college. And so I do believe that people from the working classes probably are disproportionately represented, but I don't think it's on a racial basis. It's more on a class basis.
So, Scott, when you see this sort of question of like who is in the military and what is that military service, that feels to me like it's questioning American identity at its core.
Well, I think it is, though it's interesting. I think on the flip side, too, I think that obviously people of color and other people who've been underrepresented in society, Catholics, for example, once discriminated against pretty widely, have often seen military service as a way to sort of assert their patriotism. And by doing that, hopefully winning equal rights within society. And so I think that you've seen, starting with the Civil War, in which African-American troops were a deciding factor in the Union winning that war, a large number of folks have enlisted in Civil War and the First World War, certainly the Second World War. And again, with the expectation showing that, look, I love America. I'm willing to sacrifice my life for this country and its ideals. And then when I come home, I'd like to see those ideals represented. So yes, it is a sign of patriotism, and it's one that both folks, minority folks, have used to try to advance their equal rights. But I think it's also, as you said, sort of a sense that this is some sort of statement of patriotism ipso facto. If I'm a veteran, I obviously love this country.
Is this attack on so-called critical race theory, which is really kind of a straw man here, but feels like it's an attack on sort of engaging in intellectual, academic, scholarly debates around race, is this consistent with how sort of conservative white discourse has operated over the decades, or is this a departure? Is this something new?
No, this is very much in the American tradition, sadly. I think that one of the things, we've talked about this before, Melissa, I think, you know, that this is all about a struggle for political power. It's a very cynical ploy used by some to divide America by race for their own purposes. And so we see that, for example, in the populist movement of the late 19th century. And it's not a coincidence, I don't think, that the rise of populism coincided with the implementation of Jim Crow. People were very anxious that whites and blacks, poor farmers and others, didn't align themselves in a new political coalition to try to upset the status quo, because those who benefit from the status quo like to maintain it. So we've seen this with that. And then, of course, we also went through McCarthyism, where, you know, people were forbidden to teach Marxism and socialism in schools. And there was, you know, all sorts of distrust. But again, that was not why, just as with critical race theory, it's not widely taught in American universities, let alone kindergartens. Marxism and socialism was not particularly widely taught in American colleges in the 1940s and 50s. But it was a good bugaboo to, again, sort of try to define your party, try to paint the other side as not as American as you are. And so I think you're right. This is a CRT is a straw man. But unfortunately, we set up a lot of straw men in American history.
I'm wondering, though, if it's a miscalculation. I'm thinking about your own writing and the ways that somehow knowing some of the horrors of American race, of white supremacy, actually reconnects me to my experience as an American. It gives me a sense of optimism, of movement forward, and of the possibility of change.
Well, absolutely. And as you know, that's one reason I wrote the book Freedom on Trial, was that I did want to explore my own family's history in a very important part of racial conciliation in American history, Reconstruction. Learned that my great-grandfather was a member of the Ku Klux Klan and was indicted for assaulting some black men to prevent them from voting. And yes, that you know, it did not make me love America less. It made me love it more, because you start to see the struggle that people of color and others have had over the years, women included, to try to achieve their place in society and want to see the Declaration, the Constitution, live up to the ideals that were stated so eloquently 200 plus years ago. So I think a very truthful, honest look at American history doesn't diminish your love of country. If anything, I think it expands it. It certainly did in my case.
Yeah, I would agree. Is there one thing that you would want folks to read other than Freedom on Trial if they were beginning to do some of this work for themselves?
Absolutely. One reason I wrote the book is I hoped that it would inspire people. That, as I mentioned in the book, you know, when we have ancestors that did great deeds, we put their portrait above the mantelpiece and we brag about it. We belong to the, you know, Daughters of the American Revolution and the Sons of the Confederate Veterans and all these things. But, you know, when our ancestors also do something wrong, I think that we need to understand that. And I don't say it means we inherit their guilt, but it does mean that they bequeath us with obligations to help solve the problems that still linger. But I think it's very important for all of us to take a look not only at our American history, but our family history, because often they're one and the same.
Scott Ferris is the author of Freedom on Trial, the first post-Civil War battle over civil rights and voter suppression. Thank you for joining me, Scott.
Thank you, Melissa.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.